Good day. Today is Friday, 8th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, today, Friday, 8th May, is the day before the big celebrations in Russia of Victory Day. Victory in Europe in the Second World War was pronounced in many European countries late in the evening of the 8th of May. I understand that the Germans signed their surrender document late on the 8th of May by Central European time. But in Moscow, it was already the 9th of May because of the changed differences, obviously, in the clocks. And this is why the Russians, and before that, the Soviets, celebrated victory in Europe in the Second World War on the 9th of May. And it is a massive celebration and a massive commemorative event in today's Russia. Now, today, 8th May, is of course the day before the start of that celebration. It is also the first day of the ceasefire that Vladimir Putin declared, as he usually does, in connection with the Victory Day celebrations. So the Kremlin has now confirmed the timeline of this ceasefire. It will begin today. It will obviously continue through tomorrow, 9th May, and it will finish on 10th May, allowing people in Russia and in other Soviet republics where Victory Day is celebrated to have the usual duration holiday. Now, that means that the ceasefire, Putin's ceasefire, is, as of today, already in effect. And over the last few hours, there's been reports of a reduction in the fighting on the Ukrainian front lines. Though, to be clear, this is only a brief ceasefire to cover a holiday. On the 11th of May, on Monday, in other words, the fighting will resume in full force. And in fact, in the city of Konstantinivka, the place where the fighting over the last few weeks has been most intense, the Russian military has been busy again dropping leaflets on the Ukrainian soldiers, who are now, as I understand it, mostly encircled there, calling them either to surrender or to retreat from their positions, presumably along designated corridors, but in either event, to offer no further resistance to the Russian army when it resumes its assault on Konstantinivka on the 11th of May. And for the record, Stanislav Kaprivnik, who has recently been in Donbass and who is extremely well informed about military developments and has several contacts within the Russian military, he says that the Russians are now in control of at least half of Konstantinivka. Probably that includes areas beyond the boundaries delineated by the various mapping projects. And anyway, one way or the other, this big battle, which has gone mostly unreported, does seem to me is now close to its end. So that's the situation on the front lines. But of course, if we're talking about the war in the sky, here it has been different, because Vladimir Zelensky has already made his own announcements about the ceasefire. And though they don't directly reject the Russian ceasefire, Putin's ceasefire, for Victory Day, they contradict it in such a way as to make it possible to say that the Ukrainians have rejected it? So, for starters, Zelensky announced his own ceasefire proposal, which began on the 4th, or it may be the 5th of May, but in any event, on a day completely unconnected to the Victory Day celebrations on the 9th of May, not just in Russia, but across all of the various territories of the Soviet Union. And he said that his ceasefire had no definite duration. What he sought was a ceasefire that could be extended indefinitely. In other words, exactly the kind of ceasefire that the Russians have always rejected and which they continue to reject. So Zelensky announcing a ceasefire in that way inevitably amounted to a rejection of the ceasefire that Putin announced. And, well, in the sky, the Ukrainians have maintained their air offensive, their drone offensive against Russia. As of today, hundreds of Ukrainian drones have again targeted positions in Russia on the 8th of May. I've not heard of any attacks on any buildings in Moscow or of any drones, Ukrainian drones, penetrating into Moscow itself, but there's been attacks on many other locations. As far as I can tell, these are the same pattern of attacks as we have seen many times. Maybe they're not particularly devastating. Maybe they don't do very much damage, though every so often civilians do get killed. And I learned yesterday that the very high apartment building, which was struck by a Ukrainian drone a few days ago in Moscow, with, so I'm told, only superficial damage. Well, it turns out that it is the same apartment building as the one in which a friend of mine actually has his apartment. He, by the way, is safe, as is everyone else in that building, including the occupant of the penthouse apartment at the top of the building, which was also hit. But anyway, put that aside. So far, there's been no reports, or at least I haven't yet seen of any reports of civilian casualties, but civilian casualties do occur. They do take place, and they do take place in various places in Russia. We're not talking about large numbers of people so far, thankfully, but that doesn't mean that people aren't killed as a result of these Ukrainian drone attacks. So anyway, the Ukrainians have continued their drone attacks. The Russian air defences are, of course, operating. There is no reports as of today of counterstrikes by the Russians. But the very fact that the Ukrainians continue to conduct drone strikes on Russia on the day, the 8th of May, when Putin's ceasefire comes into effect, tells us, of course, that Zelensky and the Ukrainians are disregarding, ignoring Putin's ceasefire. Whether they will attempt anything on the actual combat lines, whether they will try to regain territory, is another question. But for the record, my own view is that they don't have the means in any place to change the overall military picture on the front lines to any very great degree. As I will discuss later, I've had another big report about the actual situation of the Ukrainian army on the front lines, and I don't believe that it is in a position to mount any sustained counterattacks in any place even during a period of a ceasefire. Now, what the Ukrainians do today is one thing, but what will really matter is what, if anything, the Ukrainians are going to do tomorrow. Because tomorrow is the day of the big celebrations, and in particular of the parade in Red Square in Moscow. And that is a parade which Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, and other high-ranking Russian officials will attend. Foreign diplomats will also be present at this event in Moscow, as will foreign dignitaries, including, for example, Robert Fico, the Prime Minister of Slovakia, who is, of course, the head of government of a European Union state. So all of these people are due to be in Moscow on the 9th of May. Zelensky, in typical style, has threatened them without actually explicitly threatening them. He's saying that he doesn't understand why these people would want to be there. He means the foreign visitors in Red Square on the 9th of May. He suggested that it might be unwise for them to be there. It's clearly a threat. Zelensky has made many threats of this kind in the past. His threats can never be wholly disregarded. On Christmas Day, he made comments about, this is, I should say, the Western Christmas Day. He made comments in an address to the Ukrainian people about how the Ukrainian people pray for the death of a certain individual, though he didn't name the individual in question. It was obvious that he was referring to Vladimir Putin, and in fact, shortly after his prayer, or if you can call it a prayer, his address, we learnt that Ukrainian drones had targeted the Valdai residence in Novgorod region, where the Ukrainians and probably the Americans, in fact, I have no doubt the Americans, believed Vladimir Putin was present, waiting by the phone for a callback from none other than Donald Trump, the president of the United States. As I have said many times and in many places, I don't, as it happens, believe Putin was in Valdai on that occasion. I believe he was in the Kremlin, but that's not the point. We could see that Zelensky made what was in effect a threat about Putin, and it was a threat at that time that he was acting on, and he's just made a threat against diplomats and world leaders present on Red Square on the 9th of May, in other words, tomorrow, in connection with the Victory Day celebration, which will take place on that day. And again, I don't think it would be wise to ignore this threat, extraordinary though it is. For the record, this threat has gone, as far as I can see, entirely unreported in the media in the West. Well, as we know, as I discussed several days ago, the Russian Defense Ministry has issued its own warning. They have warned that if the Ukrainians do attack the Victory Day celebrations on Red Square tomorrow, then there will be a devastating retaliation by Russia, and this will strike targets in central Kiev. And I have pointed out in a previous program that the wording of this warning from the Defense Ministry, which is absolutely clear and unequivocal, appears to me to suggest an intention, a decision by the Russians to use Oreshnik missiles as part of this attack on central Kiev if an attack on the parade on Red Square does indeed take place. And as I have also pointed out, It is inconceivable that this threat was given without the express agreement and authority of the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin. And I think it would also be incredibly unwise, reckless in fact, for the Europeans, the Ukrainians, Ukraine's Western backers to ignore this threat. Though for the record, in London, that is what the media have mostly been doing. Now, the Russians have also said, the Defence Ministry said in its original statement, that in light of this extremely tense situation, it might be sensible for civilians and diplomats to leave central Kiev. And, well, I don't know whether diplomats from any global south countries have heeded that warning, but the European Union has made defiant statements that its diplomats will stay, and I'm sure that is also true of Britain and the United States. And, well, Zelensky at least seems outwardly unintimidated by this Russian warning. The warning from the Defence Ministry, which, as I have also said previously, is unprecedented and is far and away the most powerful warning, or threat if you prefer, made by the Russians against the Ukrainians up to now. Anyway, the Russian Foreign Ministry has now backed this warning from the Defence Ministry. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesman, Zakharova, has also been saying that this is a serious warning and one which needs to be taken very seriously. And she has also again urged civilians and foreign diplomats to leave Kiev on the 9th of May. Well, we will now have to wait and see what happens, what does indeed happen over the next few hours. I am going to here express my own personal view. I believe that the Ukrainians are not going to attack the Victory Day celebrations in Moscow tomorrow. There have been sort of threats and warnings from Ukraine about them doing something like this in the past. But in the event, they have always balked from doing this. I think the same will be true this time. I think that behind all the bravado and all the bluster, I think the Europeans absolutely do not want to be caught up, to have their diplomats caught up in retaliation by the Russians against their facilities, against Western diplomatic facilities in Kiev. By the way, I should say that Russian media sites have rather provocatively been providing satellite pictures and maps upon which they have been designating likely targets that the Russian military, presumably with their Arezhniks, might strike if there is a Ukrainian strike on the Victory Day parade on the 9th of May. My guess is that there will be, and that there probably are, intense calls by European officials and perhaps even American officials to Kiev, telling the Ukrainians under no circumstances conduct strikes of this kind. I suspect in the United States, instructions have also been given to the staff of the Central Intelligence Agency and the other intelligence departments within the United States military not to assist the Ukrainians in conducting strikes on Moscow on the Victory Day celebration on the 9th of May. I suspect that there is just enough understanding in the West of what an extreme provocation this would in fact be. It has, of course, never been attempted at any point in the war up to now. And as I said previously, I think that despite all the bluster and the bluff, I think that in the West, they do understand that because of the symbolism of an attack on the Victory Day, on the 9th of May, this Russian threat or warning does indeed need to be taken extremely seriously. So I don't think there will be an attack. Moreover, there are lots of reports that the Russians have ringed Moscow with air defence systems. And as I also discussed a few days ago, there are rumours in Moscow that the head of the Russian Aerospace Forces, General Avzalov, who was appointed, by the way, to that post in something of a hurry when his predecessor, the far more capable but also far more controversial General Surovikin, was dismissed as a byproduct of the Prigozhin mutiny of 2023. Anyway, there's been rumours that Avzalov has been sacked and has been replaced by someone else, perhaps someone who has a closer and stronger understanding of how to conduct the air defence situation. And anyway, I think that the Russians are anyway ready and prepared. And if any Ukrainian drones are indeed launched towards Moscow, I suspect that Moscow's air defences will be ready for them in advance of this event on the 9th of May. Having said all of this, this is a tense and fraught situation. And though Zelensky has sort of implied, and the Ukrainians have sort of implied, that they might do something like this in the past and have not done so, I think that there is a possibility that this year it may be different. About a week ago, Vladimir Putin himself made some comments about the way in which the Ukrainians are conducting the war. He said that the Ukrainians are very much on the back foot, on the front lines, that the Russians are breaking through and are advancing and are gaining territory, and that the Ukrainians are going from one defeat to another. That's what Putin said. And then Putin said that in light of that, the government in Kiev, actually he called it the regime in Kiev, is becoming increasingly reckless and desperate and is resorting, therefore, increasingly to terroristic actions. And, well, this came shortly after Putin received a report of about the Ukrainian drone strikes on the refinery in the Black Sea port of Tuapse. But, of course, he will have had other drone attacks in mind as well. So, Putin has been receiving these reports. He was also talking about the Ukrainians resorting increasingly to terroristic methods. Well, some people might take issue with Putin's language, but it does seem to me that there is increasing signs of nerves in the West about the direction that events have been taking. A couple of days ago, I discussed an extraordinary report that had been published by CNN, or reported about by CNN and by the Financial Times. And by the way, it's also since then circulated more widely in the British media. A report published by what was referred to as a European intelligence agency. I am sure myself that it was one of the British intelligence agencies. Anyway, this report spoke about a Kremlin that is descending into fear and paranoia, and which sees threats of assassination against Putin at every side, and which now fears a coup. I discussed this report in detail, and I said that it seemed to me that it was completely detached from realities. But it's also very much part of a diplomatic, or rather a narrative, that has been widely circulated, at least in Europe, over the last few weeks. This is of the Russians trapped in a stalemate on the front lines, of the Russians suffering enormous casualties and making no progress, of increasingly successful drone attacks taking place across Russia, of the Russian economy buckling under the stress of the war, and of Putin himself extremely nervous and frightened and wary of potential coups, worrying about Sergei Shoigu, of all people, leading a coup against him, hunkering down in a bunker beneath the Kremlin and worrying about somebody, either Ukrainian or Russian, coming after him. And that narrative has continued over the last couple of days. So I read, for example, an utterly threadbare article this morning in The Economist about how Vladimir Putin is supposedly losing the support and confidence of the Russian people. Now, I have heard and read reports of this kind extending back to the first year of Putin arriving on the political scene back in 1999. There have been dozens, not dozens, scores of reports like this. At the time of the protests in Moscow after the elections in 2011, there was a particularly rich crop of these sort of articles. We have them back. They are there once more. As I said, to say that the evidence is threadbare would be actually to be generous to these articles. I mean, it basically all seems to boil down to a single social media post by a single Russian celebrity who is, I have to say this, largely unknown to me, or until now, entirely unknown to me. But anyway, these reports are circulating. They are also, by the way, being actively circulated on social media in the West. Some people who take their news in the West from social media, I notice, are picking them up and are recycling them, and think that there might be something that indeed suggests that the Putin's grip on power in Moscow is weakening. And of course, one continues to get lots of people who come back with the narrative about how the Russian people are becoming frustrated and impatient with Putin because of the slow pace of the war and his supposed weakness and all of this. And you could see how this campaign plays into that narrative, which is already out there. And well, it's obvious to me that there is a concerted attempt underway at the present time to create a climate of tension and crisis both around Russia and in Russia itself, to suggest that things are close to falling apart there. And this drone offensive that the Ukrainians have been conducting, these various attacks, mostly pinprick attacks on Russia, are absolutely and categorically a part of it. And, well, going back to that report that I talked about, which was discussed by CNN and by the Financial Times, CNN actually let slip the reality that the reason that there is this campaign to try to get this sense, to manufacture this sense of crisis, this atmosphere of crisis around Putin and in Russia, is because European governments, European agencies, have basically lost hope of any other way of winning the war in Ukraine against Russia. An internal crisis in Russia, generating an internal crisis in Russia, is, according to CNN, the sole strategy the Europeans have left to achieve victory. Now, in this kind of fevered mood, I am sorry to say that it is indeed possible, or so it seems to me, that in Kiev and in Europe, there will be some people who will go for broke. They will say that we have to press forward with this attempt to destabilize the situation in Russia. The opportunities presented by an attack on the parade on the 9th of May in Red Square in Moscow are too great to pass over. And for that reason, despite all logic, despite all the risks of doing such a desperate and extraordinary and reckless thing, such, by the way, a deeply immoral thing, I think that there is, I'm afraid, this time, a real possibility, a genuine risk that it may be tried. With Zelensky, the possibility that he might do something like this is always there. But this time, I think the pressure on him to do it, his own inclination to do it, is probably stronger than ever. And this time also, I worry that there are people in the various European capitals who are keen or who are willing to encourage him to try it. Because these people may calculate that maybe the Russians are bluffing and that there won't be an attack on the center of Kiev. I think they're wrong about that, by the way. Or they may say, even if the Russians do carry out that attack, it will never have the impact that the Ukrainian attack on the Victory Day parade in Moscow would have. That will indeed sow doubt and fear in Moscow and generate further criticism of Putin and generate a crisis in Moscow. And that, after all, is what we want to see, because it is our sole and only strategy for winning this war, which we are not only losing, but which we are losing fast, in circumstances where there is another crisis in the Persian Gulf, in the Strait of Hormuz, which is going to lead to a much bigger crisis in the European economy in a few weeks' time. And we must therefore get on top of that as soon as possible, because we need that crisis in Moscow now. We can't wait much longer. The front lines in Ukraine might crack, but even if they don't, the European economies are likely to crack, undermining our entire strategy of trying to keep everybody in Europe united behind this war. So this, I'm afraid, is why I think that this is an unusually dangerous moment in this war. Why I think that the Ukrainians might actually this time give it a try. I think even if they do, I think the Russians have taken enough precautions to secure the parade area and the attack won't take place. But if I'm wrong about all of this, if I'm wrong that, and there is an attack and it does get through and some damage is done and some people are killed, well, then all bets are off. And, well, we could see this war escalate to a degree and extent that we have not seen up to now. One person I should add who ought to be particularly concerned about all of this is Donald Trump, the President of the United States, and his officials. I would have thought that the last thing they want at this moment, given the situation that they've got themselves into in the Persian Gulf, is a massive crisis in Europe. I hope they understand this. I hope they are on the phone talking to people in Europe and above all in Kiev, and, as I said, giving their own instructions to the intelligence agencies in the United States. But I have to say that I often get the sense that in Washington they are asleep at the wheel. And besides, there are all sorts of people in Washington who, when it comes to Russia, are obsessive and hardline themselves. And they may say to themselves, well, this is the moment to give it a try, because they too support the plan to destabilize and provoke a crisis in Russia. For the record, if there is an attack on Red Square, I do think the Russians will retaliate in the way that they say. But further, I don't think it is going to create the kind of crisis in Russia that people in the West imagine. Again, I think most people who assume that simply don't know this country, Russia, very well, and don't understand the sentiments of its people. An attack on the Victory Day parade will be seen as an attack not just by Ukraine, but by the West on Russia itself. I think that the anger in Russia would be extremely great. There might indeed be some anger directed at the leadership. There might be some criticism of Putin, but it would be criticism very much of the kind that insists on further strong action to prosecute the war and to bring the war to a victorious conclusion and to forget about any possibility of compromise with Zelensky, Ukraine, Donald Trump, or anyone at all in the West. So that is what I personally think the actual effect of an attack of that kind on Red Square would be. Now, in previous programmes, I have also discussed why so much of this narrative about a fragile mood in Russia seems to me to be wrong. I've discussed how, in fact, We seem to have had a significant economic rebound in March. We've had services PMI figures appearing for April, which also show a real rise in PMI. We are not yet in expansion territory, but we're just coming very close now. There's also been further reports of the financial bonanza that the Kremlin is receiving from the higher oil sales, which so far are unaffected by these Ukrainian drone attacks. And of course, the news on the front lines overall is good. And it's important to say that most Russians by now will have relatives who are in the military. And most Russians follow the war quite closely and are reasonably well informed, certainly better informed than people in the West, about what is really going on. So I don't myself see any evidence of this fragile mood in Russia. My sense, on the contrary, and Gordon Hahn and I discussed it on a programme we did on the Duran about 2 weeks ago, is that Putin's position continues to be very strong and that confidence in him from the Russian people continues to be very high. I don't see any sign of his grip on power or on the Kremlin or on the elite or on the wider Russian public weakening. And I think that this whole premise, this whole calculation upon which the West and the Ukrainians seem to be working is wrong. What it is in fact actually doing, what it is really doing, is it's not weakening Putin's position as such, but it is increasing pressure on Putin to take a harder line with the Ukrainians and the Americans and ultimately with the Europeans as well. Now, I say that in light of certain comments made by Putin's foreign affairs aide, foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov. He made comments yesterday in which Ushakov said that there's no need to conduct further negotiations. The Americans are busy with other matters, dealing with the Persian Gulf. So they aren't really in a position to participate in any negotiations in any serious way. And besides, we Russians, the Ukrainians and the Americans all know what the position actually is. We all came to an agreement together back, we and the Americans and the Russians came to all sorts of agreements in Anchorage. He didn't actually mention Anchorage, but that was clearly what he was referring to. The Ukrainians have been told, following that meeting in Anchorage, what they need to do. At the very least, though Ushakov did not mention this, the name Donbass, he didn't actually use the word Donbass, but at the very least, they need to withdraw from Donbass. Perhaps they need to retreat from other places as well. Back on the 14th of June 2024, Putin said that the actual fighting might end, there might be a ceasefire, if the Ukrainians withdrew completely from Donbass, Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. And by the way, Ushakov's words are not inconsistent with that formula. But anyway, Ushakov said that if the Ukrainians take this one big step, and he might have meant, he probably did mean a withdrawal from Donbass, but it might have also been Zaporozhye and Kherson region, then the fighting would be suspended. An interesting choice of words, by the way, which certainly leaves open the possibility of the fighting resuming later if there aren't any follow-up negotiations. But he said that this is the first step that the Ukrainians must take. They must withdraw from whatever contested region. Well, this is the first step that they must take. Probably, as I said, he meant a withdrawal from whatever contested region Ushakov, Putin and Trump know about, which we don't. Most guess Donbass, possibly Zaporozhye and Kherson too. That the fighting would then be suspended and there could be further negotiations in the meantime to resolve things. But the word suspended falls short of a ceasefire or the implications of a ceasefire. It would mean rather a pause so that if the negotiations got bogged down, the Russians would be quickly able and free to reactivate again. Just saying. But unless that happens, there's no reason to talk to the Ukrainians. They know what they have to do. They are not doing it. There's no reason to talk to the Americans. They know what they agreed. There's no reason to discuss it further with them. Until the Ukrainians, until Zelensky, make the decision to do what must be done, there is really no point in negotiating or talking or discussing anything. Now, that is interesting language. It suggests that the Russians have come to the view that the negotiation course, the diplomatic course for the moment, is dead. Whatever it was that Putin and Trump agreed in Anchorage, Trump has not delivered on it. Zelensky has dug in his heels. There's no sign that Zelensky is ever going to change on this. Whilst Zelensky remains in place, the war will just continue. And that seems to me the best way to interpret it, to interpret Ushakov's words. And, well, that's, by the way, the way his words, so far as I can see, are being interpreted in Russia. Now, what that means is no further negotiations about Ukraine between the Americans and the Russians. Not just no negotiations between the Russians, the Americans and the Ukrainians, but no further negotiations between the Americans and the Russians. The Russians are saying, well, we agreed everything that needs to be agreed. We sorted it all out a year ago in Anchorage. There really isn't anything more to say. All those plans that Witkoff and Kushner were bringing to Moscow last year and early this year, the 28-point plan, the 27-point plan, the other points of plan, all of that is just nonsense. There's no point in wasting time even debating any of this, because the fact is that we came to that agreement in Anchorage and the Ukrainians have dug in their heels and the process has not even reached first base. So the Russians are closing the door on negotiations. At least they're doing so. Putin is doing so. He's doing so in this typically polite way. But that is the effect of it. Of course, other Russians, Medvedev, Lavrov, others, are a lot less polite about these things than Putin is. But you can look beyond the politeness at the substance, and the meaning is perfectly clear. There's no reason for further negotiations, no reason for further discussions, because we agreed what needed to be agreed. The Americans know what they need to do. The Ukrainians know what they need to do. They are not doing it, so there is nothing for, nothing more, therefore, that needs to be said. Some people will take issue with the very polite and careful way in which Ushakov and ultimately Putin are speaking. Perhaps they're right to criticize it, though it is always Putin's instinct to keep doors ajar, at least with the Americans. And I suspect also he continues to be under some pressure from his friends around the world to go on doing that. But the meaning, when you unpack the words carefully, or pass them carefully, is clear enough. So the war goes on and will go on because, regardless of what happens over the next few days, the negotiations are over, they are dead, and the outcome is being fought out and determined on the battlefields. And, well, I've discussed already how it's a total, entirely wrong to say that the military situation is in any sort of stalemate, and why there are very good reasons to believe, in fact, increasingly strong reasons to believe, that the era of the drone, the era of drone dominance, is indeed now coming to an end. Now, on that topic, yesterday, I received another very lengthy message, email, from one of my regular and extremely reliable sources. And, well, this person, who is extremely well informed, that's all I think I can say about him, and who has been consistently right, that's another thing I'm going to say about him. Anyway, he's provided me with a very careful explanation of the state of the Ukrainian army. And it's interesting because he comes from a different background, but what he said in this email dovetails very closely with what we have been told on the Durand by Stanislav Krapivnik, with whom he did a program which I expect is going to be published on the Durand this weekend. This is that the Ukrainians are now critically short, not just of manpower, but especially of trained manpower. That there are large areas of the front lines now which are basically vacant of troops. That Ukraine is also desperately short of armoured vehicles, of shells, of artillery, and of rockets. That drones are about the only remaining weapon system that the Ukrainians have in reasonable supply. That the Ukrainians are trying to use drones to the extent that they can to plug the front lines. That this doesn't work all the time or especially well. The drones are very fragile. They don't operate well in areas of dense foliage like forests. They are vulnerable to high winds and bad weather. They are less effective at night. But drones are what the Ukrainians have. They are not effective. They're not especially effective in offensive operations. The Ukrainians have not perfected or developed drone warfare in the way that the Russians have done in order to carry out strikes behind Ukrainian front lines. The Russians have developed great expertise in using their drones to attack Ukrainian logistics centres and supply convoys, cutting off the front lines from supplies. The Ukrainians don't have enough drones and enough operators to do that successfully. And besides, because of their shortage of infantry and of other equipment, of artillery and weapons and things of that kind, they need all the drones they have to counter the attacks by the Russian infantry, which take place on the front lines. And this is not something that can be replicated in attacks. Drones used in this way against the enemy's infantry are far more successful when used from a position of defense than used from a position of attack, which is why when the Ukrainians do conduct counterattacks or attacks, they do so almost entirely now using light infantry without much artillery support and without much in the way of armoured support, and as a result suffer very heavy casualties and are unable to hold their positions. This is perhaps more from Stanislav Kropivnik, what I'm just saying, than from this latest source. And besides, what this latest source, the source who wrote to me yesterday, also said that there has been no case in modern war where the war has been won by over-reliance, by this level of reliance on a single weapon system. So drones are only partially effective on today's Ukrainian battlefields from a Ukrainian point of view. And, well, if their effectiveness is reduced further, as I said in my program yesterday, the very thin Ukrainian lines will at that point be left naked. They will not have the artillery, the firepower, the armoured vehicles, or the numbers of infantry sufficient to hold on successfully to their positions. Now, I said in my programme yesterday that Stanislav Kropivnik has been told us about various technological developments to counter the Ukrainian drones. And I said that people should wait and watch his program, the program we're going to do on the Duran, where we host him, where he discusses all of this. I will say that Almaz Ante, the gigantic Russian design bureau and company that is responsible for air defense technology in Russia, have already spoken of their success in developing an effective drone tracking system, which is due to enter service. And, well, I happen to know or have heard of other technological developments, which I also believe are going to end this period of the drone. to what extent the Ukrainians, the Americans, and the Europeans know about any of this, I am not sure. But I believe that this is coming shortly, and we will certainly start to see further evidence of this by certainly the midsummer, maybe sooner this year. Anyway, that's the situation for the moment, as far as I can see, in the conflict in Ukraine. Russian officials have for some time now been hardening their rhetoric. I've discussed this in various programs. We've had Lavrov, we've had Medvedev, we've had Ryabkov, we've had Ulyanov, all of them talking in very hardline terms. We've had warnings given to the Baltic states about their practice of allowing Ukrainian drones to attack targets inside Russia whilst overflying their airspace. There's been an extraordinary development here because, sure enough, Latvia in particular has acknowledged that precisely this thing is indeed taking place. They've issued a statement saying that Ukrainian drones do indeed overfly Latvia in order to hit targets in Russia. They say that they don't interfere with these drones, not because they've given the Ukrainians permission, but because if they did shoot the drones down, then they might land in Ukraine, in Latvia, and do damage there or kill people. That's an absurd explanation, by the way. I mean, what Latvia ought to be doing is not sitting on its hands and saying, oh, it's so bad, it's a terrible thing that all these drones are flying overhead and we can't really do anything about it. What Latvia ought to be doing is complaining to Ukraine. They ought to be making strong protests to Zelensky and to Kiev. They ought to be complaining to Brussels, to NATO and the EU. They ought to be making strong diplomatic representations for this practice to stop, which of course is not what they are doing, which confirms the extent of their complicity in all of this with respect to Ukraine. Complicity, which is really very extraordinary, because there is apparently video footage of a Ukrainian drone actually attacking or striking an energy installation in Latvia itself. What that is all about, I simply can't understand. Maybe the Ukrainians have been tipped off that that facility carried Russian oil, and for that reason they attacked it. It wouldn't surprise me. I happen to know that despite all the claims and all the statements and the various sanctions, the Baltic states almost certainly do still perform some kind of transit role in terms of exports and imports between Russia and the outside world. But I'm not going to explore this tangled and rather sordid reality further in this program. So anyway, the Russians have given warnings to the Baltic states. Finland, by the way, has taken these Russian warnings seriously, and they have been complaining volubly, loudly to the Ukrainians. We see that the Latvians have taken a different tack. But anyway, for the moment, it is the Russians who have been giving these warnings. And now we see Putin green lighting possible future attacks on central Kiev, something he has always been reluctant to do up to now. And, well, we see these warnings about attacks on Red Square, on the parade, being reinforced and reiterated by the Russian Defense and Foreign Ministry. So tomorrow is going to be a nail-biting day. I personally think that at the end, we will have a sense of anticlimax. I think that we're going to see fewer drone attacks overall and a peaceful parade on Red Square. But as of now, I cannot be certain that this will be the case. Now, going back to the Europeans, and I've discussed what I think their thinking is. There's been an article in the Financial Times, which again talks about discussions that are taking place in Europe about beginning negotiations with the Russians. Now, this has been an ongoing story for a long time. It was, I think, back in, I think it was early last year that Macron, for the first time, floated that possibility and got into a row with Kaya Kallas when he said that Europe needed to appoint a special representative to conduct negotiations with Putin. Kaya Kallas said that there was no need for such a representative because she already fulfilled that role. Macron ignored her and then announced to the world that he had basically appointed himself to be Europe's representative to negotiate with Putin. He then conducted a telephone call with Putin, which, as I remember, went extremely badly and resulted in nothing. He also sent two of his representatives to Moscow in December. The Russians met these two representatives. The people who met these representatives on the Russian side were Ushakov and Kostyakov, the head of Russian military intelligence. The Russians were completely unimpressed by these French representatives who came to Moscow with empty-handed and saying nothing new and basically told them to leave. And the entire negotiation, such as it was, collapsed at that point. Well, Macron and Meloni then refloated this idea of a representative to be sent to Moscow in December, at the time when there were the discussions underway in Europe about providing loans to Ukraine, the discussions that led to the 90 billion euro loan. And it looks as if there's been further arguments and rows about this. Kaya Kallas made an extraordinary, bizarre, ridiculous speech in which she said that it was a mistake to try to persuade the Russians, to engage the Russians in negotiations. People were spending too much time worrying about that because the Russians really showed no real interest in capitulating, which is basically what Kaya Kallas was saying. So until the Russians do show some signs that they're willing to capitulate, to accept European, Western demands, there really isn't any point in talking about them. As I said previously, there is a brilliant article by Ian Proud, my friend, the former British diplomat, on his Substack site, The Peacemonger, in which he takes this whole Kaya Kallas approach to diplomacy. He takes it completely apart. Well, it seems that these discussions about eventually appointing some European representative to meet with the Russians are still ongoing. It's clear from the article in the Financial Times that there's been no agreement as to who this person should be. There's no agreement as to what this person should propose to the Russians. Obviously, Kaya Kallas thinks that talking to the Russians at all is a mistake. The overall impression I got from the Financial Times article is that even those who advocate talking to the Russians do so half-heartedly and insincerely and have little real sense of any plan or proposal or suggestion that could be taken in any way forward. So that's it. I think that this article in the Financial Times has provoked a certain amount of attention in independent media. I don't think it justifies the attention it's getting. When you read it, the overwhelming impression I got was of a European Union that is unable to make a decision on this issue. It senses that everything is going wrong, or at least some of the people sense that everything is going wrong. They are aware of the looming energy crisis that they're going to face in a few months' time. But in terms of a diplomatic or negotiation strategy that they want to address to the Russians, they're coming up with nothing at all. By the way, the one thing the Financial Times article did clarify a little was the message that the French brought with them to Moscow when they went there in December and met with Ushakov and Kostyakov. Apparently it was a long whine and complaint that the Russians talk only to the Americans and not to the Europeans. The Europeans have repeatedly tried to gate crash the discussions between the Americans and the Russians. And in February, they tried to gate crash the discussions between the Russians, the Americans, and the Ukrainians. The Russians repeatedly tell the Europeans that you're not wanted, you've got no useful ideas you can put on the table. As I said, Ushakov and Kostyakov told the French, I believe it was in December, to get lost. And of course, it makes even less sense now, because these talks between the Americans and the Russians and the Ukrainians, which the Europeans have been trying to gate crash, the Russians now say have lost all purpose and are not going to continue anyway. Not only is there no sign of any coherent diplomacy from the Europeans at the present time, but it's obvious to me that the Europeans have, to all intents and purposes, in diplomatic terms, already missed the bus. Here is what I think is going to happen at some point over the next few months. I'm not giving it a clear timeline. I think there's going to be first a military crisis in Donbass, and then I think Donbass is going to fall. I think the Russians might then offer a temporary ceasefire for the Ukrainians to withdraw from Zaporozhye and Kherson, and perhaps to engage in further talks. I think the Ukrainians will almost certainly reject that, and the fighting will continue, and the Russians will press on to Odessa and Kharkiv and eventually to Kiev. That, I think, is the most plausible way that things are going to develop over the next few months. Certainly, I don't believe that either in Kiev or in Europe there is any interest in ending the war, at least not in ending the war on Russian terms, or what would be seen as Russian terms. Anyway, there we are. That's what I'm going to say about Ukraine. Now, over the last 36 hours, there's been another flare-up of activity in the Persian Gulf. As always, it's extremely difficult to tell exactly what's going on. The Americans say that the Iranians fired on two of their destroyers in the Strait of Hormuz. The Americans did fire back. There was reports of an explosion in Tehran. The Americans then rushed to say that the ceasefire with Iran remains in effect. And when all the dust is settled, we see that the Strait of Hormuz continues to be firmly under Iranian control. I think that the reality has to be faced that that is what we're going to see. We are never going to get a completely stable or peaceful ceasefire. This situation is too much on a hair trigger for that to happen. But there was another article in the Telegraph by Tom Sharp, the British naval captain. He now has come to the view that I've expressed many times, that the United States probably will not want to resume military operations against Iran, if only because its own inventories are now so severely depleted that it is really not in a position to sustain such operations for any length of time. And that leaves us in the same impasse in which we have already been. The Americans, unable to force the Iranians to comply with the Americans' still extravagant demands, the Iranians waiting for the moment when the Americans finally come to their senses and climb down. And I'm afraid this unstable equilibrium has many weeks and months to go. And of course, in the meantime, the situation in the global economy will continue to get worse and worse. But that, it seems to me, is the reality. On our Substack site, I written a piece in which I have pointed out that in reality, if one takes objective, realistic perspectives, this is not a conflict that is particularly difficult to solve. The Americans say they don't want the Iranians to have a nuclear weapon. The Iranians say they don't want to have a nuclear weapon. There are issues that need some kind of resolution. There are technical issues about nuclear enrichment and things of that kind. But they could be resolved. Were there any element of trust and goodwill between the parties, they could be resolved quickly and cleanly in a way that satisfies and meets the core interests of both sides. I made the point in that article, and I made it again, that I don't think this is going to happen. The United States cannot face an outcome in which it is anything else than the conclusive winner, even though a clear-cut victory over Iran now looks unachievable. And for that reason, this crisis is going to drag on until perhaps in September we have a global crisis in the world economy, including, by the way, the United States. I've discussed many times the bankruptcy of policy towards Russia in Europe. To be frank, I don't see it's any different in the United States, certainly not in connection with Iran. But anyway, that's what I think. That's where I think we are. This is where I finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. Don't forget that you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.